Comrades. Right, comrades. Revolution, in the sense that we're using the word, is, I'm quoting Marx, a more or less rapid transformation of the political and or social and economic system. Now, we ought to add, it needs to take place in a fairly short time on this definition, relevant to the things I'm going to talk about. You see, people talk about the Neolithic Revolution, discovery of agriculture, etc., etc., etc. Well, yes, it was a revolution in the sense that the method of, by which you sustained life, the mode of production, was transformed. Fine. But Christ Almighty, it took, several centuries. It was a relatively slow process. We're talking about revolutions in terms of things that happen relatively rapidly. Now, there are five talks on 20th century social revolutions and another five on the Russian Revolution alone. So, these are all 20th century. Revolutions are not that uncommon. I mean, living in Britain, you might think, my God, 1640, back to the Ark. No. On a world scale, the revolutions in the 20th century are comparatively common. The South African instance is a recent important, very important recent example, because it was a revolution, make no mistake about it. The destruction of the apartheid system meant a fundamental transformation in the political superstructure of society. It wasn't a social revolution, though. Matter which I'll come to in a moment. What matters to us, really, is the distinction between bourgeois and proletarian revolutions. There are others, but that's the fundamental, that's what really matters to us today. Are there any common factors that we can generalize about revolutions? And this applies to both kinds, political and social. Well, Lenin wrote, there were three conditions. The first was, the old ruling class cannot go on in the old way. In other words, someone paraphrased it, revolutions, or at least the immediate crack-up of the old order, starts at the top. It starts because of a crisis in the ruling class itself. Secondly, the mass of the population won't go on in the old way. That is to say, there is a radicalization which occurs quite quickly, quite rapidly. And thirdly, that there is a coherent and adequate leadership of the oppressed classes. Three conditions. But wait a minute, we have to go back to Marx. You see, that's absolutely right politically, but as Marx says, changes in the economic foundations of society, that the entire immense superstructure, political, ideological, and so on, is more or less rapidly transformed. Again, back to South Africa. You see, why didn't P.W. Botha, etc., go on in the good old tradition of Hoerth, Milan, and so on, hold the thing? Answer, because the economic conditions, which were fundamental to the regime, or any regime, were changing. The comparatively rapid industrialization, the development of factory industry, and so on, meant that the old forms, again in Marx's terms, turned into fetters. They got in the way of capital accumulation. They were a bloody nuisance to big business. Hence, the ruling class itself starts to split. And so, first reform, they attempt a series of reforms, and in doing so, they precipitate the actual revolution. Now, I so far talked about changes in the economic structure, and so on and so forth, but there is a very important component to any real revolution, that is, a revolution in ideas. Characterized. First of all, there are rapid shifts in ideas. Secondly, there's an expansion of the range of ideas that are considered by ordinary people, and third and most important of all, people who you might say, if you were a bit contemptuous, didn't have two ideas to rub together in their pocket, suddenly take up aspects of fundamental social changes. Now, I'll give you a couple of examples. The Great French Revolution, that's the 1789-96 one, didn't happen in Britain. Nevertheless, it had a profound effect on both artisans, I won't call them workers because most of them weren't wage workers, but artisans and intellectuals. You remember the, you don't remember, the poet Wordsworth wrote, "Bliss was it in this dawn to be alive. To be young was very heaven." Now, Wordsworth was not a revolutionary, far from it. In fact, in later life, he's writing, he became a popular establishment poet. He was conservative and even reactionary. Nevertheless, the impact of the event transformed consciousness, or sections of consciousness, and so on in every case. Do you remember the three women? I'm not going so far back this time. The three Portuguese women who wrote what we could describe as a feminist pamphlet, booklet. No? Ha ha, time passes. Right. Well, look. You see, I referred to the Catholic Church in Ireland and its stultifying effect, particularly on the position of women, in a previous discussion. But actually, I should have ignored Ireland. I should have taken Portugal. Because, though the Irish Church 20 years ago was still half in the Middle Ages, it was positively progressive compared to the Portuguese hierarchy. This pamphlet, its essential contents were, one, women ought to have equal rights with men. Revolutionary idea. It was a revolutionary idea in Portugal in the early 70s. Two, contraception ought to be legal. All right. And third, there ought to be a system of child benefit. Now, this sort of thing, written in London, Paris, Berlin, or wherever, would have created no sensation whatever. And such ideas are commonplace. Some of the objectives had been achieved or partly achieved. But in Portugal, it had a sensational success. The print run was sold out in a very short time. There were many, many editions produced, some pirated, and so on. Why? Because the actual conditions in the opening stages of the Portuguese Revolution were such that people who had previously accepted, even if they didn't like, the ideas of the old order. My God, something different is possible. Anything is possible. There's a story, I don't know if it's true or not, that one or two of these more energetic of these middle-class ladies who produced this subversive work spent a little time going around in northern Portugal talking to illiterate or partial barely literate peasant women gathering round, listening. You know? In other words, the ideological transformations are integral to any real revolution and they are of fundamental importance. Mind you, the other side of the coin, if the revolution is aborted, partially aborted, people slide back, the new ideas are marginalised. The old ideas revive in various forms. The process of the general, and most people drop the thing altogether, the general ideology of the population shifts, changes with revolutionary ups and downs. It shifts and changes without revolutions, but in revolutionary situations it shifts and changes at enormous speed. Now, second generalisation, and this again applies to both political and social revolutions. Phase one, everyone's united, except the reactionaries, of course. We're all united around a set of demands, different classes are united, and so on. the springtime. But within, after the initial phases, within a comparatively short time, you get a rapid differentiation amongst the very people who supported the revolution in the first instance. You've gone far enough, that's enough, let's keep what we've got now, or we've got to go further to preserve what we have, quite apart from the fact that everything is possible in some people's minds, and we must go further. This reflects, of course, a class differentiation. Broadly speaking, there has never been a revolution, certainly not a proletarian revolution, bourgeois or political one either for that matter, in which the mass of the petty bourgeoisie, sections of the middle classes, did not initially support it. But then, once the first phase is over, in 1789, once the Bastille had been stormed, everyone's for the revolution, except the aristocracy. And even some of them, as a matter of fact. Very shortly after, however, the revolutionaries divide. To simplify, this is a simplification, you get division between Girondists and Jacobins, and they conflict with one another. And the third phase, the conflict becomes open. Often becomes violent. Often is decided by force. You see the same thing? I keep talking about Portugal because there isn't a talk on Portugal, the Portuguese Revolution, which is rather surprising. In Portugal, of course, everyone was against the old regime, except the reactionaries, the secret police, and so on and so forth. But within weeks, not months, we had a clear division between those who wanted to go forward and those supported by the CIA, the German Social Democratic Party, financially and otherwise, who wanted to stop, who wanted to stabilise the situation, who thought it was getting out of the hand because workers were occupying the factories, not just passively occupying, but operating the factories. We can't have this. And those who wished to go further. And finally, of course, this conflict was resolved by force. Not in our favour. Now, let's go back to Lenin's three conditions. You see, the first two are fairly simple. It's important to remember the first one. There's never been a revolution without a crisis in the ruling class itself, and that is usually the precipitating factor that the mass of the population rapidly changes its ideas. That's fairly simple. But the third thing, the reasonably coherent and competent leadership. Again, let's look at South Africa. I'm trying to think of recent examples, you see. We look at South Africa. Ruling class was in crisis. Mass of the population, it was increasingly difficult to hold them down in spite of a really massive coercive apparatus of police, soldiers, secret police, and so on and so forth. That was there. What wasn't there, though, was the leadership. Not that there wasn't a leadership, there was. The ANC. And the ANC's objective was not a workers' revolution, but rather a stabilization of the capitalist system to fit the changed conditions. And, no question at all, they successfully did that. I'm not saying it's going to go on forever, but for a period anyway, up to the present, they have. So, when we talk about leadership in modern terms anyway, we can forget about Cromwell and Robespierre and so on. We're talking about parties. Leadership must require a political organisation, a party. Why? Well, there are three reasons. One is the question of ideas. I said, ideas shift rapidly, people are transformed and so on during any revolutionary process. But come on, ideas don't fall from the sky. There must be people arguing them, propagandizing for them and so on in advance. That's simple enough. But then tactics. You see, we know from experience, unfortunately, that although under certain circumstances, purely spontaneous movements can have Considerably, in fact. Nevertheless, they are ephemeral. They don't last very long. Unless there is some kind of leadership. Look at Poland in, what was it, 81? Solidarity, etc. Now, the ideas of solidarity, suppressed by the regime, the ideas suppressed by the regime, nevertheless didn't come from nowhere. Lech Walesa and all the rest of them had a set of ideas which you can loosely call social Catholicism. And those ideas were the ideas which spread rapidly once the regime started to crack and continued to spread after the initial repression under Jaruzelski and so on. Consequently, the outcome, the ultimate outcome, all the preconditions, the first two preconditions for revolution were there, it stopped. It was aborted at the political stage. Finally, of course, there's the question of numbers. Now, we're sitting in this room with the most correct ideas in the world in our heads, supposing we have them, and with a mastering of tactics and so on and so forth, nevertheless, cannot make a revolution in Britain, even if the conditions are right. There aren't enough of us. A party which is to have any serious effect does require numbers. Now, that's a complicated question. It doesn't mean that at all stages it has to have numbers, but come the crisis, without numbers, no. You are marginalised. Okay? So what sort of party? Well, first of all, the Workers' Party, the Workers' Revolutionary Party, cannot be a passive reflection of the ideas current in the working class. That's pretty obvious to us, isn't it? I mean, it won't do to go around to your local pub, assume it's in a working class area, and reflect the ideas that you hear discussed over the bar. By God, you are. That's not our function. No. In that sense, the party, throughout most of its life, is not representative. It is not true that the party represents the class. Actually, that's another passive conception. It means, in reality, it doesn't lead. It's a question of a conscious striving to achieve leadership in all those situations where it is possible. And not simply a propagandist one, but an interventionist one. You remember, the Russian Marxist Plekhanov coined a useful distinction. I think it's useful anyway. Plekhanov is, a bad man in the Leninist tradition. The later Leninist tradition, I mean. Lenin thought he was good. He said, the distinction is this. Propaganda means many ideas are put across to a few people. Agitation means that a few ideas are put across to many people, or as many as you can reach anyway. Okay? Both are necessary, but without agitation, it's not simply a question that, we've got to win this, that, or the other cause, but the question of the development of the organisation itself. A couple of years ago, when Skaga was starting up the SLP, there was a meeting called in Hackney, not indeed by Scargill's own people. I don't think he had any people. I have no doubt he had a lot of sympathisers, but by a combination of sects, one of which called itself, I thought it was a particularly good example, the Provisional Central Committee of the Communist Party of Great Britain. Provisional, you see. Of a party which doesn't exist. We're talking here about a dozen or so people. But it's going to be all Great Britain and so on. Now, you see, what's lacking is interaction with the working class of the members of the Provisional Committee with the working class. They lack the intermediate thing, you know, they lack the party. But the party itself needs leadership, and this is a more contentious thing. I hope we'll get some criticism on it. You see, Why is this so? Well, different people, different layers of people in a party at any given time have different experiences, different levels of knowledge. Not that knowledge is always necessary for militancy. different experiences, and experience can be a bad guide as well as a good one. Above all, there has to be a continual interaction between the party members and the class they are aspiring to lead. And inside the organisation, there has to be a constant interaction, which quite often leads to friction, between the people who happen to be on the leading committees of the party at any given time and the membership. But even that won't do, because there are members and members. You see, we have a layer of members, quite a significant layer in numbers. Some of them call themselves sympathisers, but they're effectively members in the same sense as the layer of membership I'm talking about, who are enthusiastic about this or that, will now and again do something, now and again engage in activity. We are not really interested in dialectical materialism or you name it, right? These members are essential. Under conditions where a party grows rapidly, actually there will be a majority. No question about it. You deceive yourself if you think otherwise. There has to be an intermediate layer, a cadre. The term is of military origin. It referred originally to NCOs. That was the French army, adopted by the British, the Germans, the rest of it. A cadre, meaning not super theoreticians or people who are experts on economics or whatever, but people who are seriously committed to building the organisation and who have this dual relationship. Relationship with workers outside the organisation, relationship, an interactive relationship with the leadership of the time being. Now that's the hardest thing of all to achieve. I don't want to sound rude, I spent a quarter of a century as one of them, but actually, if the Central Committee were to drop dead tomorrow, we would be able to replace it, not at random, but precisely because we do have a cadre in the sense I'm talking about. Now, let me illustrate that with a couple of examples. You see, in April 1917, Lenin, arrives at the Finland station and makes a speech which horrifies the dignitaries, not the Irish anymore, of course, but to various shades of alleged socialists, including a number of Bolshevik leaders, and in effect tears up the party program, said, we must work towards taking power. Now this is completely contrary to the Bolshevik doctrine as it had been up to that time. The democratic dictatorship of the proletariat. Sorry about these jargon phrases. What it means is, you're fighting to achieve a democratic republic in place of the Tsar. Why? Because the economic development, the transformation of the productive forces, which is totally inadequate for socialism in Russia, will be accelerated. Meanwhile, we are in opposition trying to build a working class movement and so on and so forth. Therefore, talk about take power now. The man must have lost his marbles. No. There was her, and that was the position. Lenin was in a small minority in April. But in the course of a very fierce, sharp, internal conflict, which immediately followed, he was able to win over decisive sections of the cadre. People who'd never been on a central committee, people or even district committee in many cases, actually were won to him, and so in a comparatively short time he was able to achieve a majority. That the magnitude of the change is enormous. The interesting thing is, without the Bolshevik cadre, not just the membership as a whole, it could not have been achieved. Contrast, Rosa Luxemburg, January 1919, not much later, newly formed German Communist Party, growing quite fast but tiny in relation to the Social Democrats, have a conference, decide enthusiastically they must take power. Now, by means of an insurrection in Berlin. She argued that this was nonsense, that this was impossible. Patiently explained, you know, you have to win a significant proportion of the delegates to the then existing workers' councils, Räte, they were called in Germany. And at the moment, well, any worth talking about, we've got to get a majority in the workers' councils before you can think of attempting to seize power, exactly as the Bolsheviks had to work between February and October to win a majority in the Russian workers' councils. They wouldn't listen. They were enthusiastic. They had seen the Kaiser flee to Holland. They had seen the generals put away their uniforms and pretend we're not really them, you know. And so all the transformations that occur very, very rapidly in a revolutionary situation. And, well, it's been done once, we can do it again. By an act of will. Well, they tried. The result was a catastrophe. The insurrection was defeated. Some people supported it. I don't mean to say they were without support. I don't mean supported it by saying so. I mean, but by doing it. But they were defeated by the forces of reaction, who were then under the direction of the Social Democratic Party, who had a great majority in the workers' councils in the Räte, and who denounced these the German Communist Party as putschists, blanquists, so on and so forth, and who received the support, passively, but received the support of the great majority of the working class. Now, what's the difference? Allowing for differences between the Russian and German situation, but they're not decisive in this respect. The lack of a cadre. Rosa Luxemburg was preaching in the wilderness. There were not a sufficient number, there were only a handful, as a matter of fact, of people who had gone through the lengthy process of learning, developing, and so on, had some sense of tactics, of what is possible, what's necessary possible. The party had only existed a few months. So, cadres can't be improvised. Central committees normally can be improvised, at least if you've got a Lenin. Luxemburg around, but perhaps even Cliff. Oh dear, I must speed up. Cadres can't be improvised. Right, there are a few other things that I really should talk about, but instead I will summarise. First of all, a revolutionary party cannot make a revolution until the conditions are ripe. Marx used the analogy of midwifery. You know, he described the revolutionary drive as the midwife of the new, yeah, that's right, the midwife of the new society struggling to be born. Well, striking analogy. Trouble is, if the fetus isn't viable, the best committee of midwives can't possibly produce the infant. The conditions must be right. Secondly, of course, who decides? Who decides? To judge the conditions, to judge whether, it's not difficult in Britain to judge that we're not ripe for revolution at this minute, but actually in changing circumstances you've got to change all the time your emphasis, your orientation. To judge successfully requires experience. It requires that all members of the party, although they do it in different degrees, through their activity, learning from workers as well as trying to teach them, acquire the knack. What did Lenin call it? He didn't use the word knack. I don't think he knew English slang. But anyway, he has an impassioned passage about this. It can't be improvised. It does depend on a considerable degree of experience, both working with people outside the party and participating in the direction of the party at the same time, so that the leadership itself, which typically is not working on the buses or what have you, does not directly relate to workers in their workplaces, has to be all the time under the pressure, under the influence, if you like, as well as influencing the people who do. And finally, unless the party is substantial. I've touched on this before. You need numbers. Good. The process of getting numbers, I'll do this very quickly, is a very uneven one. For the first 15 years, more than 15, 18 years, the founders of our organisation and a few people who joined them never exceeded 100 people. Tremendous events took place during these years, tremendous struggles in Britain and all the rest of it. Nevertheless, we had in 1950 or 51 some 30 odd members, and come 1967 we might have gone up to, I doubt this personally, but nevertheless, I mean, that's my personal impressionism at the time. We were claiming about 100. That's it, we were claiming. And then, in the course of 9 months, we had over 1,000. And it was real. That's the explosive rate of growth. Suppose we'd gone on growing at that rate. We'd be a mass party now. Marvellous. But of course, not marvellous, because changing conditions meant, inevitably, that the rate of expansion slowed, and not only that, actually, in the 70s, the first half of the 70s, the rate of expansion was negative, i.e., on balance, we were losing members. In connection with that, of course, is the question of the need, as I've talked about before, to change your tactical orientation. We changed it fairly rapidly. The ANL, we would not have considered such an operation in 1970. Wouldn't have considered it. Come on, the central thing's the industrial struggle. And it was at the time, it was marvellous. Come on. The industrial struggle goes down, the social contract, the labour leaders and so on and so forth goes down. Fascist organisations are growing. It was the National Front at that time. Therefore, we need a fundamental shift in orientation, which we managed to achieve without too much trouble. The trouble came later, when the fascists were no longer the main problem, and the difficulty was to convince some enthusiastic comrades that actually we have to shift the emphasis. Okay, but we do need numbers. And to take advantage of situations where rapid growth is possible, we need the largest possible number of members in the here and now. Okay. Now, this is our task. This is basically what we have to do in Britain, and the socialists have to do internationally. There's certainly going to be many struggles, many shifts in the tactical line. I don't know what they are. Actually, nobody knows what they are, because you don't know what the situation, the exact situation is going to be in, let us say, 2000. Many struggles. And a good deal of learning. Because we don't know everything. There are problems we haven't even thought of yet. I can't think what they are. But I'm sure they're there. You know. So we come to the question of the world situation today. Crisis of capitalism, wars, internationally, upheavals of all kinds, basic instability which is reflected in the sphere of ideas. You know, people are no longer confident, people, I'm generalising, but large numbers of people are no longer confident that actually, in Britain, as somebody put it, my children will be better off than I am. They believed that in the 60s and to some extent the 70s, and with some justification. Don't believe, large numbers of people don't believe it now. In these circumstances, yes, it's on the cards. I'm not putting a time scale on it. Can't. Nevertheless, it's on the cards. Final question, therefore, is, but are we up to it? Can we actually build the necessary, coherent, flexible, revolutionary party? Well, by our very existence, we affirm that we believe we can.